Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Just the Facts. Alex Zane here. Hope you're well. As always, a quick little bit of housekeeping before we get into this week's interview. You can follow us online on Twitter or Instagram at JTFpod. And also, as I always say, if you'd rather watch this interview instead of listening to it, or do both, that is always an option. You can do both. You can listen to it now as this podcast, or if you really want to watch it, which is a great idea, by the way, you can find it on our YouTube channel, Just the Facts with Alex Zane, where it will be up in a few days' time. Right then, my guest today is a fantastic young writer, actor, and director who has a brand new play, slash book, slash film, all in the process of arriving on stage, page, and screen in the near future. So the book is called Instructions for a Teenage Armageddon, and it's based on a play which is going to be doing a run in theatre soon called Instructions for a Teenage Armageddon, which in turn is going to be a movie that is currently shooting called Instructions for a Teenage Armageddon. I have made that sound way more complicated than it is. My guest today will make it a lot less complicated, and it sounds absolutely brilliant. But the book is the main thing, because it's coming out very soon, October this year, Instructions for a Teenage Armageddon, and she's going to tell us all about it in a much, much simpler way. I don't know why I made that so complicated. Apologies, but there you go. That's how I've chosen to put it out there. Also, she has built up an incredible, eclectic acting CV. She starred in horror, she starred in drama, she starred in a Hollywood comedy alongside Sarah Jessica Parker, and she's also been in numerous TV shows, including Outlander. So a lot. But that is kind of to be expected when you begin your acting career at the tender age of 4 years old on stage at the National Theatre. It was an absolute pleasure having her on the show. So please welcome to Just the Facts, the wonderful Rosie Day. Rosie Day, hello.
Hello.
Hello. We were just talking about your five cats. That seems like a lot of cats.
It does. An actress gave me a cat as a present. As the cat was being handed over and the door was being closed, it was like, wait, she might be pregnant. And the cat gave birth during lockdown, and so nobody could come and see the kittens. And then obviously we spent all our time with these cats, and now they're just our pack.
So there was never a plan to give them away? You just got attached to them, I guess.
Yeah, because we couldn't have people around to come and like see them and, you know, kind of put them up for, you know, adoption as you would. So no, they just, they stayed, and now we have our family of cats that live with us. And my sister is like deathly allergic to cats. So she can't come around my house anymore. It's not great.
What, how does she feel about that? That seems like you've lost a sister and gained five cats.
We found out on Christmas Day, and I can't say it went down particularly well. My mum had bought me all these like cat toys, but we hadn't actually told my sister that we'd got a cat. So it didn't go down great, I'm not going to lie.
Okay, so how on earth does one break the news that that one of your closest relatives is no longer going to be able to attend your residence?
My mum did it. My mum was like, yeah, they've got a cat. It really didn't go down well. But she really likes them. She can come and like stand at the door and kind of see them for like 10 minutes, and then she can't because she can't breathe.
It's weird. Like, I was allergic to cats as a kid, and then it just went away. Maybe it'll go away.
It'll go away. Maybe if she has more exposure to them, it'll be like, it'll disappear.
Yeah, it'll desensitize her. I mean, like, I don't think either of us are medical professionals, so I should prefix this with the advice we're giving right now is not medical advice. But yeah, you spend enough time with cats and your allergy goes away.
Exactly.
So listen, you've got so much going on right now, which we're going to get into, but I thought we'd start at the beginning, which for you really is the beginning. Like, 4 years old, am I right, that you began acting?
It's stupid, isn't it, when you say that? I have a four-year-old in my life now, not my four-year-old, my friend's four-year-old. And I look at her and I'm like, why would you ever put her on the stage? She is so tiny. I was four and a half. My first job was at the National Theatre. I don't know if I'm the youngest person to ever work there, but I probably was the youngest person that could like talk. I think they might've had some babies, but I was four and a half and yeah, they're like my earliest memories are sort of running around the National, which is a bit weird.
So you do remember them? Because when I found that out, I was thinking back, going, "What do I have a memory from 4 years? I think maybe Lego. I remember I had some Lego, but that's it."
I can remember this. It was a play called Summer Folk with Simon Russell Beale, and I can remember the play. I can remember going on stage. I can remember doing the job. I can remember eating. I only ate like rice and ketchup in the canteen. That's what I ate for dinner of the day.
So sorry, you're going to have to pause there. What now? Rice and ketchup?
Well, I still to this day am a ketchup addict, like with everything. I just used to eat plain boiled rice that they had in the cafeteria and just sachets of ketchup.
Okay. And I mean, you're a ketchup fan still. That's fine. A lot of people are ketchup fans. Would you still put ketchup on rice? Is this what?
I mean, I'm not joking, not sweet things, but all like I am known to have like ketchup with my roast dinner. Like it's that level.
Okay. Okay. I mean, look, you know what? The expression that I'm pulling right now is it makes it look like I find this weird.
It really does. It's cool.
Yeah. I mean, of course, so other people must have talked to you about this. I can't be the first person to go, sorry, what now?
No, everybody goes, that's disgusting. I like it. It's how I like my food.
Hey, and this interview is not, it's not even an interview. I'm not here to judge. I'm accepting of all weird food habits, which this is pretty high. But okay, so you remember running around the National Theatre eating rice and ketchup. But do you remember actually thinking, hey, I quite like this acting lark?
I remember thinking, hey, I quite like missing this, not having to go to school. That was, I think, because when I was little, it was my sister. So my big sister was one of those all singing, all dancing, annoying children. And she got cast in that play and also a TV series. And they needed a little sister for her. And I sort of ended up along for the ride. I think a casting director asked me, I'd come to like an audition and she said, oh, would you do some acting for us, Rosie? And my mum said that I went, no, acting's stupid. Why would I want to do that? Like, I just had no interest in it. Then I think my mum explained that I got to miss school and I really wasn't like into school at all. So I was like, I'm in, count me in.
That's a young age to start. And yet, like, it didn't stop there. I mean, was there a point where you caught the bug and it stopped being about missing school and started being like, actually, this is something I quite like?
Yeah, I was about 10 when I did a TV show called Burner's Watch, which was like a kid's show about a boy who could stop time. And that was when I was playing like a really mean girl in it. And that was when I was like, oh no, this is fun. Like, the idea of creating a character and getting to be someone else. Up until that point, you just kind of get cast as people's children, I guess. And so that was probably like the moment that I was like, oh, this is a thing. Acting is like a thing that you can kind of do. So that was probably that's when my mum says anyway, that I was like, oh no, I want to be an actor. This is fun.
That's interesting, because I think I remember hearing that you really like playing unlikable characters. And so the first character that you played when you actually fell in love with acting was itself an unlikable character.
Oh, yeah, she was very, very horrible. I think unlikable characters are far more interesting.
By the way, I've just noticed a wonderful selection of spirits behind you. I hadn't clocked that at the moment. That's some collection you've got going on there.
Don't drink at all. I hate the taste of alcohol. So these all belong to my partner, who I promise is not an alcoholic.
So one of the things that you did as a kid, and I don't know whether you remember this, I'm sure you must do if you remember being at the National at 4 years old, but you were in one of my favorite sketch shows of all time, which is I always chew Simon Pegg's ear off about how good this show was and how much I miss it. I think it had two seasons, which is Big Train.
Big Train, literally. Yeah, I remember that so clearly because it was so much fun, because I got to do, it was a spoof on the Raging Bull thing. So I was playing De Niro's character with the gloves and was like getting to be on a boxing ring and kind of punch lots of big, muscly guys. And I was teasing, I think I was about 8 when I did like that one, and I was so, so little. And then, and I was working with Rebecca Front, who played my mum, who I then worked with again about 3 years ago and kind of got to know really well as an adult, which was like a really weird thing because I was like, I worked with you as a kid and now we're still here. It was really, really funny and really, I remember really enjoying that one, and that still gets brought up. People often talk about that one to me.
Being on stage, like from 4 onwards, did it really normalize the experience of getting on stage? Like, do you now, when you, I mean, obviously you've done a play recently, which we'll talk about, but do you get nervous, or is it because you've been doing it for your entire life? Do you just sort of go, yeah, I know this, I got this?
I found theatre. So I did a lot of theatre as a kid, probably till I was about like 11. And then I didn't do any until I was about 21, and kind of through various, I don't know how to describe it, slightly uppity people, was told because I didn't go to drama school that I couldn't do theatre as an adult. And that was very much something that was like forced into me, into my brain, thinking I wasn't good enough essentially to be on stage as an adult because I hadn't had that training. And it was only when I started working with a director called Hannah Price, who was like, you can totally do theatre. What are you talking about? Like, that's nonsense, that I kind of recently have got back into it. And yeah, it absolutely terrifies me, but in the best way. It's like the best adrenaline rush that you can kind of ever have. But I genuinely had about a 10-year break from doing it, just because that's the way what the industry was sort of telling me. But now it's like my favorite thing in the world.
That's crazy. So there really is. It's weird that you say that. My guest last week on the show was saying a similar thing, that there is actually a snobbery in the industry, not only about whether you went to drama school, but then on top of that, which drama school you went to.
And you better not be a child actor growing up, because, oh, that's, you know, that has its own sort of stigma around it, really. And I think if you haven't then gone and trained, people kind of, I don't know what they think, because, you know, when you've grown up on a set, you kind of just learn. I learned how to act from watching other actors. That was sort of kind of how I did it. And I think that's quite a unique, but quite a cool way to kind of do it. And then, you know, it's all about the directors that you work with. If you work with really kind of creative, brilliant, open directors, then anything's sort of possible. It's just, I think, the very traditional people that like, you have to go to RADA to be national now. Like, yeah.
So, I mean, so that was like your late teens, early 20s when that was happening. Do you think that's changed now? The industry has changed, or does that kind of that snobbery about drama school still exist?
I think we're definitely sort of paving the way for change in the industry as a whole and being far more kind of inclusive and sort of, you know, giving lots of people a lot more opportunities. But I definitely think that there is still a snobbery, and it's theatre is a very protected club. Like the, you know, the people that get seen for the auditions at kind of the Donmar and the National and the, you know, and that's sort of the same sort of people that get brought in, and you kind of have to work your way into that club still, which is really difficult to break into, I think. So, yeah, no, I do think we still kind of have that opinion and that snobbery around it.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because there was that whole conversation recently about how it is, you know, it's kind of an exclusive club. Like, to be able to go to drama school in the first place is a privilege, like, that not everyone can have. And so it results in, I guess, a certain kind of a person who ends up being an actor, you know, depending on your background and whether you can, is the word afford, but be in a position, let's say, where you can experience that.
Exactly, yeah. And if not, it's whether you can kind of fundraise. You know, you see kids that are having to, you know, fundraise online just to try and get to drama school. And I think that's really, really sad. And I know drama schools have kind of been reworked over the past sort of year or so and are going through a big overhaul, which is great. But yeah, I think it still is a sort of club that a lot of people are kind of locked out of still. Hopefully that'll change.
So what do you, apart from obviously a character being fundamentally unlikable, which is brilliant, what do you look for when a script sort of lands in your lap, and what are the things about it that make you go, yep, that is for me?
It's usually, I mean, I think most episodes, but it's like the story, whether the story's been told before and the writing. I think all of great filmmaking and kind of TV is in the text. And usually I get a script and I go, okay, who's going to get cast in this? That's not me. That's generally the first thing I do, which is probably a really bad habit. I think of all the kind of other actors before me, they're like, oh, they'll probably get that. They'd be really good for that role. I should probably be a casting director instead. I mean, it's all down to, for me, I think as a woman, it's like, how are the female characters written? Like, is it kind of our story or like a female story? And whether, you know, really, if it's just a kind of story that's worth telling, really. And for me, yeah, it's all in the writing and kind of whether there's something that I think that's interesting about it. But also it's whether you're like, do you think it's reasonable that you're going to get this job? And then you can kind of get excited about it, you know, if you think it's sort of plausible. Because, you know, sometimes you get sent scripts that you're like, you know, that Spielberg are directing and you're like, oh, I wish. Like, that's kind of how it that's kind of how my brain works.
So, I mean, you talk about the fact that, you know, how are the female characters written. So do you think that's changing at the moment? So we're here in 2021. Have you noticed that the roles that and the scripts that you are being sent have improved in the quality of the way the female characters are written?
I would say yes, for sure. But I would also say they are predominantly written by men. That was a really good, I think The Guardian did an exploration to that, and it's still like 12% of scripts are written by women, and they're original stories, they're not adaptations. So no, they're usually written by men still. But yeah, I would definitely say that there's a conscious effort to try and tell women's stories, but it's not often women who get the chance to tell those stories, which is kind of with me because I played a lot of teenagers growing up, and so often it was written by like a 50-year-old white man, and the teenage girl would be so badly written that you'd just be like, because they have no experience of it. And it's not to say you can't write something that you don't have experience of, because of course you can, but it's always the very stereotypical kind of trope that they often go down.
So you'd say, like, so there is a marked difference. I'd imagine there would be, but not reading scripts. I couldn't say for sure, but I imagine there is a marked difference between a female character written by a female writer compared to one written by a man.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an honesty to it that I think that that you just get when it is your own sort of lived experience, when you have been a young woman, rather than kind of somebody imagining it in a way. And, you know, the amount of stuff, you know, I've only just stopped playing teenagers, but, you know, every teenage girl character description was like ridiculously beautiful. You know, that was always in the character description. You're like, why can't you just have a teenage girl that just looks like a, you know, a girl and who's just, you know, that hasn't got to be emotionally distressed or incredibly sarcastic or troubled or, you know, hating their parents. That's the other one that used to drive me up the wall. I really liked my parents growing up. So yeah, character description. There should be a podcast in itself where someone just reads character descriptions of women over history. I think that would be worth it.
So over your career, and this is for me, because I really think every actor needs on their CV at least one good death scene. And you have collected a fair few over your career.
I have. That's the fun of doing horror movies. You often get to die.
I want to go through some of them, so because they're great, and they are really. When I was sort of writing them down in a prose form, I was like, that just reads like a good death scene. So, Good Omens, for example. So you did Good Omens. This is only recently.
We love Neil Gaiman. I only got that job because I met him at an award show and sort of befriended him, and because I'm one of his like biggest fans, and then that kind of came about that way. And I'd worked with the director before and essentially just harassed them to let me in it, and it worked.
How was he? I did a Q&A for American Gods, the show, but unfortunately he couldn't be there. And I was like, you know, when you're sort of trying to put a brave face on things, but when I got there and they were like, yeah, sorry, Neil's not going to be here. I'm like, oh, come on, man. What? Part of the reason I'm here. But how was he when you met him?
He's the kindest man. He's just so lovely. He was so, so lovely to me. And you know, we exchange tweets sometimes on Twitter, and he's a really good egg.
Yeah, he is. So your death in Good Omens, was he there that day when you were shooting? Because I know he was the showrunner on it.
No, he wasn't, no.
Oh, well, either way, I just wondered whether he was going, and now you get engulfed by a billion maggots who eat your flesh, who then turn into the Antichrist.
Yeah, Cash. Standard day at the office, literally standard day at the office as she got eaten to death by maggots. There was only one maggot on set that day, but it was in my headphone. I had like a little, you know, the Britney like mic, and it wouldn't do what it was supposed to do. So I just had to sit there probably for about 15 minutes while they tried to get the shot of this maggot wiggling out of my mouthpiece, just trying not to gag, because they really smell.
So that's one death scene, brilliant death scene for poor Lisa in the call center. Next, so this is a director. I guess, would you call yourself one of his players? Because you've made three movies with Paul Hyatt.
So Paul gave me my first ever film. And I guess we kind of have that sort of like connection, because, you know, he kind of gave me a movie that kind of really helped my career, I guess. And so, yes, we've made a fair few horror films together. Are you going to say Howl, the werewolf film?
Yep.
Where I get flung from a train and my neck gets eaten by a werewolf. Paul Hyatt comes from special effects, so he is incredibly talented. And so that piece, I genuinely did that, like my neck had been ripped out. And my stomach, they did my stomach as well. It was very gory. And I did have to hang upside down in a tree.
It's a movie that looks beyond its budget for that exact reason, that, you know, the special effects on it are fantastic. The poor woman's leg when they're pulling back the bandage and she's been infected on the train, it's like, that's really, really good prosthetics.
It's one of those films where, I don't know, I remember we watched it, I think it was at the premiere, and lots of people found it funny. And I don't think the film was ever intended to be funny, but has now sort of taken on a life of its own where it's like this horror comedy, but I'm pretty sure that's not what anybody ever intended it for.
Yeah, werewolves. I watched it because I love a werewolf movie, it's one of those deaths, your death in it, that's really dark, because you think that your character is dead. You sort of get dragged out of a train window, disappear onto the roof, and you hear screams. But it's the fact that we come back to you later, still alive, being eaten alive.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? What we get paid to do, it really is.
And then it's another Paul Hyatt joint that is another fantastic death, which I think the film's changed names now, because it was called The Convent. And then when I was watching it on Amazon, it's called Heretics.
Yes. No, so it was called Heretics originally. And then I think they changed it to The Convent so people knew what it was about. I can't say I've ever seen that one. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say, but I had a really bad time filming that film. It was really, was not a pleasant experience. So I think I've sort of, I was like, I'm not going to watch it back. I actually can't remember how I die. How do I die in that film?
I can tell you how you die. And why wasn't it a pleasant experience?
It was just one of those things where it was sort of, it was incredibly chaotic and there were some not very nice people on the job. We were down in Wales and it rained the whole time we were there at Christmas. So it was like -5 or something. And I just remember being really, really, really not very happy on it. I think just because of that, it was not, I like to work with, you know, really kind, happy people. And I think sometimes as a young woman, when you're on a set and you can sometimes be made to feel quite uncomfortable, it can really sort of affect how you view a job. And that is probably my least favorite job, actually, that I've done. So I've not watched it, so I can't remember how I die.
Wow. Well, I'm really pleased I brought it up.
How do I die?
You die because you become possessed by a demon who causes you to stab yourself in the heart. And then when you are repossessed by this demon, you have your head chopped off and placed on a spike.
Well, I know. I remember filming the spike. I remember filming having my head on a spike. Yes, but I don't remember killing myself. And how funny! I must have blocked a lot of it out. Clearly. But wow, that's gory.
So those are my favourite three deaths of yours. Thank you for going through them with me. That was a pleasure. But you mentioned that your very first movie was with Paul Hyatt, which you got a great number of plaudits for your performance in, which was The Seasoning House.
Yeah, it was a very dark film, but it was based on a true story set in the Balkan War about young girls being prostituted by the military and sort of used as pawns. And I was playing this kind of this deaf character who kind of helped in this house essentially, it was an amazing experience. It was quite a tough shoot. I think we shot it in like a month and a half, and I was doing my A-levels at the same time, but it was really, really cool. Like, it was a really cool experience kind of to have, and I kind of got to learn sign language, and you know, I think about that quite a lot now, because I don't think if that film was made now, they would cast a deaf actress to play that character, and rightly so. You know, that we shot that over 10 years ago now, so I kind of often think about that, how I ended up doing that role.
And in terms of it being your feature debut, were you sitting waiting for the right role to come in, or was it just a coincidence that that role came in at the right time?
It was just one of those things where I was at school and I think they'd seen like 150 girls or something. And I was one of the last girls to go in for it. And my agent at the time actually hadn't read the script for it. So he didn't know how dark it was. And it wasn't until he came to the premiere that he was like, wow, yeah, that maybe should have read that script for you. I was under 18. So I really didn't think they were going to cast me, because I thought, you know, for like legal reasons, they'd have to cast like, you know, an 18-year-old that looked young, you know, as they often do. But no, they did pick me. And it was very, very fun. I did a lot of my own stunts. I kept coming home with like more bruises and scratches. They had a stunt double, but I was like, let me do it. So yeah, no, it was really, really, I had a great time shooting it.
Well, you talk about your age, and you know, it is it's a bleak film which deals with some very dark themes, and you're 16 at the time.
Yeah. And then you go back to school and you're like sat in, you know, English. Which is like, I remember my first day back and I was like, this is very different to what I've just been doing for the past month and a half. It's, you know, that it was definitely, I think, you know, there's a lot of sexual violence in it. And I think looking back on it now, where I am now in my life, you kind of go, that was probably a lot to process at 16 when you're kind of watching actors, you know, portray rape or something like that. That was probably quite, probably did have an effect on me, I think, moving forward in my life, because that's something that you don't often see as a kind of 16-year-old.
But you did get to work with Sean Pertwee, who is a freaking legend.
He is a legend. He is the loveliest guy. And he was so kind to me. He was so lovely.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Was so supportive.
Yeah, he's in one of my favorite movies of all time. I say my favorite movies of all time. I have a lot of love for this movie. I feel that if I say it's one of my favorite movies of all time, people go, uh-huh, really? But Event Horizon, it's a sci-fi horror. Anyway, I bumped into Sean in a bar once and I literally, I walked away and the following day I went, I think I was that guy, because I just plonked myself next to him and chewed his ear off about Event Horizon and everything that he knew about it.
I love that though. I always be a fan. I think I'm such a fangirl of so many things and so many people. I think it's a positive quality.
Well, we've talked about horror, and I don't know whether the term fangirl is relevant to this, but you did get to work with a great comic actress in the form of Sarah Jessica Parker on All Roads Lead to Rome. So, were you a fan of Sex in the City before working with her?
So. That was a job that I went for the audition. I was like, well, I'm never going to get it. Like, I'm never going to get that job. And my mum turned around in the kitchen and went to me, well, don't go to the audition then. But I did go to the audition and I did obviously get the job. And so no, hadn't seen Sex and the City, but obviously knew what a legend she was. And I remember meeting her for the first time and like, I was shaking just because I was like, oh my God. And then literally had the best 3 months of my life. Ever in that job, because we were in Rome together and we just had, it was just magical. She's a really incredible woman who is incredibly kind and incredibly just kind of wonderful. And that probably, I think, will always be one of my favorite jobs for the rest of my life.
So at the audition, did you sort of walk out thinking, actually, you know what? I think I did pretty good in there.
I could do the character really well. Like, I was like, I could play her. It's just, I didn't think I looked like Sarah Jessica Parker. And also, like, it was an American movie and it just didn't, I just was like, I don't think that that's ever going to happen. And I actually got told by my agent's assistant that I haven't got it. About a week later, I had a phone call. I was nannying some little kids. And this agent Humphrey phoned him and was like, you've not got the job. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. Then about 3 days later, on a Saturday, my agent phoned him and was like, you booked the job. And I was like, oh, he told me I hadn't got it. And my agent was like, no, we hadn't heard. We were just waiting. So I'd been told I hadn't got it. And then my agent phoned on a Saturday and was like, you've got the job. And I was drying my hair. And I remember literally putting the phone down and just being like, shell-shocked by it.
Of course, you remember exactly where you are. That must be one of those moments where you're like, this is a big one. This is a game changer.
I think as an actor, they always say like the best day of the job is the day you get the job. I think it's good. But you remember, you know, I have those moments where I can remember where I was at the time and their, you know, their memories that are so like kind of like etched in your mind. I had one day, and it's only happened once, where I booked two jobs on the same day. And that I think probably has to count as one of the best days of my life, because it's like, you book two jobs on the same day, which never happens ever.
Wow. Big jobs as well.
Yeah. One of them was Outlander. So that it was a good day. It was a good day.
Because we had Sam on the show not that long ago. So you worked with him on a film before Outlander.
We worked on a film together. He'd just booked Outlander, and then he was going away to film after we shot. And we were in the Lofoten Islands, which is the very top of the Arctic Circle, where it's light 24 hours a day, shooting this kind of very quirky Henrik Ibsen sort of film. And so we got to know each other really well, because we spent all of our time kind of together, the kind of key actors. It was on that that he had just finished reading the second book, and he went to me, if there is a second series, there's a character that you will play so well, you know, if that happens. And then cut to, I think it was about 18 months later, I was playing that character. And he swears he had nothing to do with that like decision, but I mean, I don't know, but he is one of the kindest men. I love him. He's just wonderful.
Isn't he? And you know, whether he did or didn't, it's nice that he says he didn't.
Yeah, I know, isn't it? Like he's like, oh no, I'll let you have it off your own merit. But no, like but that's, I think, Sam all over. I think he's so generous. He's so lovely. And that show is such a, you know, iconic thing now. Like it was, because I did the second series where it was kind of, you know, had a huge family, but kind of hadn't quite expanded into what it is now, which is, you know, something kind of on a global scale.
Have you had experiences of the fans? Because when we did the interview with Sam, it just exploded, because like the fan base for that show is incredible.
I did a couple of like Comic Con things, which was amazing to meet them. I've never done anything like that, where you get to meet people and they are so passionate and they know everything. And you know, they knew way more than I did about, you know, I'd read the book, but I didn't know, you know, the level that they knew. And they're so, you know, it was the first time I think I'd ever been in anything that had a fan base. And so getting to experience that, where they like make you presents and like give you things. And it's, you know, it's a lovely thing. Wow.
It must be scary though. Like, what? Because obviously like you're in it. So I guess to them, you have a duty to know everything. And so when they go, but obviously this, and do you, like this happens in this book, and you're like, yeah, I know that. Or do you come clean and go, I actually don't know anything outside what I've just done?
At a Q&A, I came clean and admitted that I had never watched it. And that was not the smartest thing that I'd ever done. Simply because I don't ever watch things that I do generally. Like, I just hate watching myself. I think it's weird. So I just had never kind of got into the show and watched it. And yeah, but you probably shouldn't admit that in like a room full of like 1,000 Outlander fans.
That's interesting though. So you don't watch stuff you do. I always imagine that. So on the set, when you're performing, for example, if it's a TV show or a film, do you just know there and then sort of go, I think that's good, I got that, I nailed that? Or because I just imagine watching it back could be a research tool for going, I'm doing that and I don't want to do that.
Yeah, that is certainly true. I think on set, as I've got older, you certainly have the instinct as to whether you nailed it. But I think the more I've sort of lent to the other side of the camera, a lot of your performance is down to the edit and how they choose to edit what you've done. And so I try not to think about that kind of too much. You kind of can do your best and then you kind of give it into the hands of other people, which is why I kind of love theatre, because you kind of have a more, much more control over what you're doing, I guess. Whereas I think TV and film, there's so many extraneous circumstances. So yeah, there are certain things that I have watched and kind of, you know, you sort of, you have to end up watching bits because of when you have to put a show reel together as an actor. So you have to kind of look through things and find things that you like and that you don't like. When I was little, I used to raise my eyebrows an awful lot. So that's something that I've had to rein back in. There's a lot of eyebrow acting going on.
So this job, All Roads Lead to Rome, Sarah Jessica Parker, you filmed it in Italy. Is that part of the reason it's one of the best experiences you've had? Because I've seen it and it looks like, you know, just an amazing place to travel around.
For 3 months. And pretty much we used to go out to eat and restaurants. Obviously, she would never expect it, but most restaurants demanded that we ate for free at their restaurant. So it was just a really lovely period of time. You know, where we would go out for dinner and then there'd probably be about 11 different moments in the evening where I'd have to be like the photographer to take photos of people, because you know in Europe she is just massive. I mean, she is everywhere, but you know, I think people weren't expecting her to be in Italy. So it was, but that was interesting to kind of be on that side of things where I experienced like paparazzi and like how anxiety inducing that is to kind of be with somebody that is followed constantly. That was, I think, a real good life lesson for me. There were certain moments where we were like cycling around with bikes and people were chasing us and it was not fun.
So like, what did you take from that? Like, I'd rather never be in that position.
Yeah, that position. Because it is one of the things where we went to visit the Pope one Sunday. He was giving a speech and we were in the middle of the Vatican Square. And people started to clock that she was there and everyone started. And there's thousands of people in the square. And we were like, how are we going to get out of this? Like there was moments, because we're both very small, like we were both petite and you're just there like, I can't protect her and we're going to get mobbed. So I remember that being something that I was like, I don't think I could ever handle that. And she is so gracious about it all, but I don't think I could live like that.
Wow. I mean, that does sound terrifying. Crowd. I mean, surely that she has people like security, people going, we've got to get Sarah out of here.
No, absolutely not. It was just us two. I think she lives a very normal life. And I think because she lives in New York, everybody knows she's there and she's left alone most of the time. No, but there was no security. It was just two small people.
How did you get out, just to put my mind at ease?
This is really stupid. We ended up speaking in like a fake language and pretending it wasn't her and getting out that way. Yeah.
Oh, well done. I do like the idea of everyone being in Vatican Square and the Pope being on his little balcony and people going, yeah, but Sarah Jessica Parker's over there.
Yeah, exactly.
And bringing us sort of, I guess, more up to date. So please tell me this book isn't out, because otherwise I haven't done my due diligence.
It's not out. October
when? The 14th?
October 14th. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. I can relax now.
Yes. No, you're all right.
Okay, good. Right. Well, let's get into it then. So this is now, tell me if I've got the order wrong. So this was a play that then you've turned into a book that is now being made into a film called Instructions for a Teenage Armageddon.
Yeah, you got it right. Yeah. So we did a preview run of this play that I'd written as a joke that I didn't think anyone was ever going to see. And then randomly ended up getting put on, which was essentially all about a teenage girl's experience and wanting to put them front and center, because so often in theatre, teenage girls are side parts and the stories don't revolve around them and sort of their lives. So we did a preview run and then we were meant to go back on somewhere else and then COVID happened. So we are going on again, but not until theatre is fully kind of, you know, back. And then, but it was when we were doing that preview run that I was introduced to my now literary agents at WME, that sort of said, how would you feel about doing a book? Do you know, turning this into a sort of nonfiction guide for teenage girls to how to survive their teenage years and how to get through them. So that's what we ended up doing over lockdown, was that we wrote this book and kind of created this thing. And then kind of, I don't quite know how it happened, but then there is now a film. And I don't know how, I can't remember how that process came about, but we ended up, we've been filming this sort of hybrid feature version of the play, which is really exciting.
So the play and the book share a title, but the play is a work of fiction, whereas the book is partly written by you and you've curated it as well.
Yeah, so we have, so it's like an entire guide that has lots of different sections. So we have, you know, so we have contributors writing about different topics from like mental health to body image to, you know, staying safe to boundaries to consent to all these kind of important topics. And then we have sections that are like 10 top tips for surviving certain experiences that you'll have, and kick-ass profiles of women of note that we think everyone should know about. And it's all in this sort of big bundle of guide of female empowerment, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
That sounds great. So who did you approach, or are you not allowed to say at the moment? How did you approach them?
Gosh, that was really... Do you know what I found? Everyone that was approached about it was so lovely and kind and was so open. And the real issue was, and I don't mind saying this, was people's agents that are in the way. People's teams. And it was really interesting as an actor, because obviously you only have your agent as an actor that you deal with on an acting side of thing. And then suddenly when you're approaching agents going, could you ask so-and-so, and you sort of see the other side of things for the first time. Like, I got to see how agents work, and you know, some people had absolutely lovely, brilliant agents that were so great, and other people had agents who were, you know, not so nice. And that was really interesting. I think it's, as an actor, that's kind of interesting to know how you're represented when people approach your agent about things. So yeah, we approach, so like, we've got like Sarah Pascoe's written an essay, and people like, we've got a lot of, so Soma Sayra, who created Everyone's Invited, which is the campaign to stop rape culture in schools. We've got a lot of activism within the book, kind of, because the whole thing is centered around like empowering teenage girls to know that they can change the world and they can do what they want with their lives. So that's kind of how that came about. But no, everyone that we approached was so kind and lovely once we got to them. That's what I'm saying. Once we got through.
So like, that is, I mean, it's kind of scary for some people if they are not aware that their agent is being difficult without their consent.
Yeah, that is, I think that's something that, and I don't think as an actor you never get to experience that, because certainly I don't, obviously, because I have my team, but like, you know, you only deal with them when they're talking to you. You don't know how that whole thing kind of plays out behind the scenes. And it was quite, I'm not going to lie, it was kind of intimidating as an actor approaching agents in a different realm that wasn't anything to do with acting, going, I'm doing this book, would you, you know, pass this onto your client? And like I said, you know, some was just so wonderful and brilliant and you're like, yay, we love you. And then others were, could be quite tricky.
It's weird, because I mean, you would normally be protected from that by your agent. For example, they'd be the one sort of approaching people on your behalf, and there's a buffer between you and that experience.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas all of a sudden it's like your front line and center going, hi, it's Rosie. Could you pass this idea onto your client? And I think it's interesting. I think a lot of actors are quite scared of their agents because, you know, they get us work and they're the people that, you know, that sort of are the gatekeepers to our livelihood. And so there's a real kind of intimidation about it. And that's certainly something I felt growing up, you know, as a young woman in this industry is how agents treat you and kind of how you feel about them. And something that I try to remind like younger actors is like, or older actors have reminded me that you pay them. They technically, agents work for you. And it's something, and that power balance, I think, can be really rocky when it comes to younger actors, I think. As an actor, you have very little power in this industry other than what you say yes or no to in terms of work. And you can often end up feeling very unempowered. And I think having the right people around you is probably the most important thing that you can do. And if you're lucky enough to find them, I think that's really important.
So what constitutes, what were they doing? Were they asking, was it money? Were they going, is there a fee for this book?
Yeah, so everyone was paid, or they could have their money donated to a charity of their choice, or STEM4, which is the Teenage Mental Health Charity the book is giving some of its profits to. So lots of people came back were asking for more money, which is, you know, you expect that of agents, that is their job at the end of the day. And then some people were just a bit rude or ignored you for ages. And then or like replied and then just ghosted you. So yeah, you know, it was a real kind of learning curve. But you know, there was equally as many brilliant ones that were incredibly supportive and really got behind the message of the book, which was really lovely. But it was scary emailing agents. It's terrible to me. That's terrifying, having to approach people.
We're on the same page about that, because obviously, you know, I'm booking people for this podcast directly. So for the first time in my life, instead of someone going, "Hey, you know, you just have to be here at this time," I'm sort of like, "Hey, can I? Would they be interested in coming on?" So big shout out to CLD and Claire Dobbs because they were lovely.
So lovely. That's something that I think as I've got older, I keep saying to people that I sound like a broken record, but I just want to work with kind people. Like, that is my priority. Nice, kind people that, you know, that want to make nice work. That's kind of like my only level of in terms of what I want to do, just because I think this industry has still got a very long way to go in terms of kind of, you know, looking after women and just, you know, and people in general. You know, I think there's a lot of good in this industry and there's a lot of bad, and we're slowly rooting out the bad. But for my sanity, I only want to work with nice people.
Is that achievable? I mean, just, you know, playing devil's advocate, you know, a role comes along that is like, this is a dream role, but you have knowledge of a situation where someone is working on it who has a bad reputation. How do you weigh that up? Would you still take the part, or would you go, look, my mantra, I cannot in good conscience do this and go through that experience?
If I've heard bad things about someone, and genuinely serious bad things, I wouldn't take the role. I've lived through too many experiences on set where I've had bad experiences with people that have like affected my mental health, that I value that more than a job now. I think having peace inside you is more important than any role. And what you're doing by continuing to work with these people is, they're continually getting jobs and working. And it's only when you everyone stops and goes, we're not working with you anymore because what you've done is bad, that those people then have to leave the industry. And I think that's something that we sort of have to make, you know, make a change and do. And I'm certainly part of the change.
Well, I mean, you mentioned you're an ambassador for STEM4, which is, in case anyone doesn't know, it's about supporting teenage mental health.
Yes, so it's support and preventing teenage mental health issues and all about education. So we go around schools and we talk to kids, usually from about 13 to 16, educating them on mental health. The work they do is kind of unparalleled. Like, we have like 8 apps and like all these, you know, different amazing tools that they can find online to kind of help with teenage mental health, because right now it is in a very bad place because we have a government that doesn't fund mental health properly.
And do you think it's got worse? I mean, we're obviously different ages, but from when I was a teenager and when you were a teenager, do you think we're in a different time now? It seems to me from my end that, you know, I mean, to put it bluntly and not flippantly, even if it does sound a little flippant, I'm really, really fucking glad that I'm not a teenager in 2021.
Goodness, you could not pay me to be a teenager. I think from the statistics that I know, I think since the invention of social media, mental health issues have risen by 80%. I think that's the statistic, which is terrifying. And you don't want to be the person that bangs on about the dangers of social media, but you know, it is good and evil in equal measure. And yeah, I think especially the pandemic, I know, has had a huge, huge knock-on effect to teenagers' mental health. I know the STEM4 website has been getting more hits every day because of it. And people, you know, I think it's like a 2-year wait list to try and actually get proper help on the NHS for a mental health condition. So that's why STEM4 is really important. I think the work they do, I've seen firsthand how they change people's lives. And that's why I kind of wanted to give money from the book to them, because that's how I learnt about, you know, supporting teenagers, I guess, through them.
I think the thing that has always struck me about it, you know, from the negative experiences that I had at school, they were always at school. And then you come home, you close your bedroom door, close your house front door, and you'd be at home and you were in a safe place. And now that safe place doesn't exist because it's right there in front of you on your phone and you can't escape it.
can't escape it. And it's, so it's 24/7, and people are so much meaner online, and you know, when they can hide behind things, and you know, most of the things that are said on social media people wouldn't dare say to somebody's face, but because it's, you know, it's online, then you know, the trolls are, that's where the trolls hide. And also the whole idea of comparison, you know, you people put, we always say this like a broken record, but you know, people put their best bits online, they don't put their, you know, they don't put their worst days, and that's how young girls can end up feeling very less than others.
Yeah, I can believe that. I can believe that. Well, because you know, as a 42-year-old man who believes himself very sort of wise, if not a little cynical, I sometimes go, "How the fuck is their life so good?"
I mean, I do it as well. You know, that's I think that's just the nature of the beast, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously you worked in your teenage years. You were working in an industry not sure on sort of negative elements like rejection, you know, and just a lot of bullshit.
I think the rejection thing is really funny because I think, you know, you end up getting rejected in this industry like twice a week probably, and I think growing up with it probably made me have a very hard shell to it. Like, unless I've got incredibly far for a job that I really want, getting rejected doesn't even sort of cross my mind. But I think as a teenager, like, you, it is, there is a whole, I wasn't a particularly, like, I was quite a normal teenager. I looked pretty normal. I kind of, you know, I wasn't ridiculously pretty or anything like that. So, like, I remember, you know, you'd go to auditions and you'd see very beautiful girls, and it is intimidating, and usually they did get cast because that's what was wanted. And you know, it is an industry, or was an industry, full of bullshit, but you know, hopefully we're trying to move past that. And it probably did. It definitely probably had mental repercussions that I've not thought of yet, that I probably should go to therapy and talk about. Like, that's probably what I should do. Because yeah, it's a very odd way to grow up. 100%.
So October the 14th, instructions for a teenage apocalypse. That's when that comes out.
Armageddon.
Sorry. I'm getting my apocalypses and Armageddon's muddled up. Armageddon.
Maybe that's the next one. That'll be the next one.
And so are you filming the film at the moment, or is it done?
No, we're literally doing it. Yeah. At the moment. So it's been really, really fun. We've got a great cast of like Amanda Abington and Phil Glenister, and kind of just having, it's been really, I've been directing it, which is crazy and bizarre.
Oh, shit. Wow.
That's something that I never thought, because I directed some shorts, but I never wanted to be in the things I directed. That was always a very separate thing. Whereas now I'm in the thing I'm directing, which is a bit of a mind fuck, to be quite honest, to kind of do both. But it's certainly been a really fun learning experience.
And how did you make that? The obviously, if you've done some shorts, did you feel like equipped to actually move into a feature from doing the shorts?
I think because this is a hybrid of a play, so we have half of it is feature film scenes, and then the other half is set on a stage. So it's a kind of like this bizarre viewing experience. And because we'd done the show, because I know that piece so inside out, back to front, that was where I was not kind of intimidated by it. And you know, we have a really lovely DP, and it's kind of been a great team. We put together a great team, and I think if it was otherwise, like, I don't think I could have acted and directed something unless I knew it to the depth that I know that piece, I guess.
I guess that must be pretty cool, though. So you are the writer, director, and actor in a feature, in one whole feature.
Yeah, and it's that sounds like a total ego trip, which is why I hate it so much, which is why I was so against directing it, because I was like, I've written it, I'm acting in it, and now I'm directing it. Like, that just sounds like the road show, which makes me feel a bit ill, to be quite honest.
You own that shit. That's amazing.
I cringe, actually. Like, I genuinely slightly cringe inside. But we'll see. I don't know. Fingers crossed it all turns out okay.
And when is that coming out then? Is that, do you have a release date, or are you just sort of seeing how it goes?
We'll finish by the end of August. We'll finish filming. And then, yeah, watch this space. It'll work. Fingers crossed.
Rosie Day, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your time, and good luck with your writing, starring, and directing gig.
thank you very, very much.
Hold up.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.